Fast and Furious. That describes the change underway in scholarly publishing. Keeping up with the pace and preparing for what lies around the corner are critical challenges. Open access isn't new, but it is riding the next wave. The momentum for openness is strong, yet the path ahead is far from straight. Information in this dynamic publishing environment is precious. In April, Outsell, a well-regarded research and advisory firm focused on media, information, and technology, released Open Access 2015, Market Size, Share, Forecast, and Trends. Author of the report, Daniel Clare, has estimated the OA titles represent just under 5% of the journal marketplace, yet they clearly punch well above their weight in attracting media attention and generating industry conversation. Right now, we want to turn to our next guest, Mark Ware, who joins us on the line from London. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hello, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you join us. We're looking forward to discussing a report that you prepared for the Research Council's UK, Evolution or Revolution, you asked the question. You reported on publishers' perceptions of future directions in research communications and the publisher role, and clearly publishers are wondering what their role is in this new world of open access. And as you point out, really the trend of the sort of the most obvious trend with regard to all of this is has moved from whether to adopt open access models to how to implement them. And so, you know, you've spoken with, as we said, more than 20 different publishers of all types and sizes to learn how they plan to make that change. They're obviously managing a lot of challenges right now.
Chris, you're absolutely right. And as you said, this report was commissioned by research funders, the RCUK, on behalf of the Global Research Council. And they were really interested to understand how publishers saw the STM market evolving. So the report was based on some pretty long interviews with, as you said, nearly 20 publishers. And I think if you look at the points I put on the slide here, there are probably few surprises in terms of what people were coming back to me with as the things that they saw as the key pressures for changes. Funder policies, quite near the top there. But one thing that did slightly surprise me was the consistency with which people said that, you know, one of the key issues for them was the digital transition, because we might have thought that was something we'd already done. We're moving away from print fast, for sure. But as we dig in, it's clear that what they're thinking about has been perhaps some of the things that Denny was alluded to, that we're moving into a world, a digital world, in which focus on services for researchers and data services and what we call in the report open science or open research creates a whole new environment. I think the other point that was perhaps a little bit of a surprise was that very few people said in their top four or so that the continued growth in R&D outputs, by which I mean, you know, number of articles that are published, was one of the key pressures for publishers. Most publishers saw this as something that was manageable by publishers. 3 or 4% growth annually in the number of papers isn't an unmanageable input for them. The issues, though, arise, as we know, in relation to combining that with the pressure on library budgets.
Well, indeed, and you know, Mark, we should have mentioned at the top there that you're certainly a very qualified person to gather all this information to speak with these publishers, because you have been an independent publishing consultant at markwareconsulting.com for over 10 years now, and you're also an affiliate analyst for Outsell, and you've worked at board director level in STM and business publishing for a number of years prior to that. So you really see it, if I can put it this way, from the publisher's perspective, understand what their concerns are. And you break it down as far as the forces and the factors that are at sort of applying pressure here. And they are, surprisingly, not only business pressures, but social pressures, technology pressures, and even political ones.
I think that's right. I've pulled together those key forces here with some others which came up in conversations with the publishers and tried to put it into some kind of framework to help understand. And I think, I mean, clearly some of these interact and, you know, can be seen as aspects of different aspects of the same larger trend. One of the things which very many of the publishers highlighted was the changing researcher behaviors. And we heard some of that from Denny earlier, I think, in terms of the uptake of these new services. But things like attitudes to copyright, sharing of information, more tolerance of informal materials, for instance, the way that the stages at which people are prepared to share information, these things are all up for play. And publishers at this point aren't clear how research sort of behaviors and attitudes are evolving, how they will evolve. And that's probably one of the more interesting sort of aspects to speculate on as we go forward. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I think that also points to the point that Denny was making earlier, which is the role of the author here has really become more prominent than it has been in the past. And researchers, are doing so much more than simply contributing to these journals. They really are. They're shaping the debate. They are leading publishers in directions they may not have expected to go. And they really have begun to adopt innovative approaches to publication and to thinking about, as you say, publishing other than materials that before would have stayed in their research lab. So we're talking even now about possibly publishing the notebooks that go along with all the research.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things, of course, that's very much on the mind of publishers at the moment is the 5 to 6 million researchers who've joined ResearchGate, and the reported 16 million plus that have joined academia.edu. So those are big numbers joining those specialist scientific social networks. And publishers are obviously have some concerns as to how those networks will be used in relation to the sharing of information. But the fact is that sharing is just simply central to the way that we do research. And so we have to find ways to work around that.
Right. And we've heard from Denny about the funder policies and the ways that that's been having an impact. But open access has also introduced a variety of economic concerns for publishers, and you list some of those there. There's budget constraints, globalization. Economies of scale is something you know particularly.
Well, economies of scale has always been important in publishing. It's generally always been better to be bigger in the sense that you can get better prices from suppliers and you can afford a bigger sales force and so on. But I think that trend is being emphasized and strengthened as we move into a web-based economy. The obvious example is one of the clear examples is around services which depend on network effects. So sharing tools and social networking and collaboration platforms, there's an inherent tendency on the web for a winner-takes-all situation to emerge there, because nobody wants to be part of more than one or at most two kind of sharing or collaboration platforms. And so this tends to pull things together around one or two or three leading players in that kind of business opportunity.
Right. Well, as we're familiar as consumers with just that, we think of Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon, and that really about covers everything. We're seeing a similar movement then in scholarly publishing.
I think there will always be a very long tail, because not everything in scholarly publishing fits that model. But certainly for things like the scientific social networks I was talking about, clearly there isn't going to be space for more than one or two of those. And I think there's an inherent tendency here for consolidation within the sector. We recently saw the Macmillan and Springer merger. But there's been a host just over the last year or two of smaller acquisitions by players, and I think that will be a trend that we will see continuing.
Right. So we asked the question in the webinar invitation, open access, which direction? And you've provided some answers in your report for RCUK. And really, the top point is, as you say in the title, asking the question, evolution or revolution. What we've got here is you think, much more of an evolution rather than a revolution.
Well, virtually all the publishers saw the system as evolving rather than being radically disrupted. That didn't mean that they thought this evolution was necessarily going to be slow. It could be, a rapid form of evolution, but it was the radical disruption part which they weren't seeing. Now, I think this is right, and I think it's not just wishful thinking on behalf of the incumbent publishers, because I just don't see any evidence that leading publishers are being disrupted and displaced out of the industry, or that there's any considerable recasting at this point of the way value is created within the industry. Or indeed, if you look at outsells industry size numbers, they are very, very different from the numbers for, say, recorded music or newspaper advertising or industries that genuinely have been disrupted. So I think the publishers were right here. It wasn't just that they've got their heads in the sand. I think far from it. And there are a couple of reasons why that's the case. One of them is that simply the journal retains its relevance and importance in the research community. I mean, indeed, if anything, it's more important than ever. And I mean, certainly you could argue that it's so important that we shouldn't, it should be a goal not to risk disrupting that system. And related to that, part of the reason for that importance is the role that the journal plays within reward and recognition systems, reputational systems within research. And that makes the whole system very conservative, of course.
Well, indeed. And, another point to mention is that open access is really driving an increased competition level between publishers and in this marketplace.
Now, that is really interesting. And again, pretty well everyone I spoke to said that's the case. I think that I'm not entirely sure about that. And I think certainly we can point to the lower barriers to entry. So it's much easier now to start an online open access publishing company or to create new services online. That's not in dispute at all. And one of the things that has led to is competition, new entrants coming from outside the industry altogether, whether that's things like Google Scholar, which clearly is pretty disruptive if you're Scopus or Web of Science, or venture capital backed startups of their various kinds. So that's certainly the case. And I think what publishers were thinking is that our jobs as managers and as publishers is certainly much harder because there are more competitors and it's harder to predict where they're going to come from. At the same time, if you were looking at it from an economist's point of view, I'm not sure that I'm yet seeing the sort of effects you'd expect in a truly competitive market in terms of reducing overall profitability.
Indeed. Well, we are chatting right now with Mark Weir, an affiliate analyst with Outsell and independent publishing consultant, about his report for the Research Council's UK on trends in open access. And if you are tweeting the program, we have a hashtag. It is CCC Open Access. Mark Weir is on Twitter at MARKWR. And if you have a question for Mark or for our previous panelist, Denny O'Clair, please use the chat box in the lower right corner of the screen, and we'll try to get to as many of those questions at the end of the program as we have time for. And Mark, so in your discussions with the publishers, they look at this rather complicated marketplace, and they certainly have been working very diligently to adjust to all the changes. And there are some directions they anticipate headed and that you see as being really sort of felicitous for them. Talk about those.
Well, open access is clearly increasingly the norm. Almost nobody starts subscription-based journals nowadays, all new journals essentially are open access, and as Denny was documenting, the hybrid and the flipping options are gaining ground. But clearly the model isn't working well enough at the moment for, you know, for all stakeholders, I think. And, you know, I could just point you to the RCUK review, first year review. The large majority of the costs that RCUK put in to support open access as part of its policy, majority of that went on administration rather than APCs. It was a highly inefficient process. So, I mean, nobody I spoke to sees any practical alternative to the APC or some variant of it. I mean, and I know Denny spoke earlier about 9 to 11 or a dozen different gold open access models, and I've documented something similar in the STM report separately. But most of those are really ways of bundling or otherwise managing the APCs rather than entirely separate model. And some of those other approaches do suggest ways that the open access model, the gold model, can be made more efficient. So things like offsetting and bundling, membership schemes and prepayments, institutional accounts, and payment management systems like CCC's own rights link, for instance. But one area that did come up as, you know, potential for development was sort of agreement of standardized metadata around the process that will allow reporting, compliance, will allow institutions to understand what they're spending in effect.
There's also a point there regarding the green model. We are focused here on the gold road, as they call it, the APC model. But very briefly, what are some potential directions for green road open access?
Well, I think this is a little bit more speculative, and I kind of return to it at the end of the report and on the last slide in terms of things that we are very much worth thinking about, but we're not quite so sure as to what it is. But if you think about it right now, the green landscape is a very fragmented one, with articles deposited in a whole range of different kinds of repository, institutional, subject-based, authors' homepages, and it varies, again, substantially between disciplines as to the sort of balance of ways in which that's done. And in most cases, what you get, if you find the article, and they're not easily findable because of that fragmentation, what you mostly get is the author's manuscript. And that's not a great experience, either in terms of discoverability or in terms of the quality of what you get. Now, so the question is, are there ways in which publishers, institutions and funders could evolve a more interesting green open access model, interesting from the point of view of providing better service to the researcher without compromising the subscription model on which it entirely depends? So perhaps we'll come back to that after we've looked at the open science agenda, because I think it relates to that.
Well, indeed. And I was going to say, I mean, you know, you ask questions like that, and there's a lot of volunteers to provide answers, and I think this slide really gets at that. There's so many players who've come into this, and there's this now emerging ecosystem, as you say, of services and standards. Some of the names on the screen will recognize Altmetrics that Denny spoke about. Mendeley is one of those scientific collaboration networks that you've been talking about. What are you getting at here? I mean, this is really a more and more crowded world.
Well, this slide comes from a consultation paper that the European Commission, of all people, have been working on, a consultation I think is now closed, around open science. So the idea of open science is really centered on two notions. One of them is sort of inherent in the name, which is the openness. But the other factor is the data intensiveness of science, the extent to which research has become either a data intensive or indeed a data driven process. So when you pull together these issues. What the concept is the in the center there we have the green traditional research cycle, if you like, of gathering data and analyzing it and publishing and so on. But that's enhanced and supported by this whole range of new services and processes, if you like. Open access is part of that, for sure. But open data, freely shared, open source data, and other kinds of social and collaborative systems combine to create this edifice, if you like, which we call open science. Now, I think, you know, it's obvious that open access is a better natural fit to this model because of the open nature of it. But as we said earlier, in the real world, we're going to have a mixture of open access and subscriptions for the foreseeable future, which means a few years, of course. But we expect that to continue more or less indefinitely. So that there has to be ways, if we're serious if the research community is serious about wanting open science, and there are clearly some real benefits that have been documented in a lot of other reports, we need to find ways in which the subscription journal part of the market can be a full player, if you like, within this open science model. And that's a really interesting challenge for publishers, I think.
Well, I can imagine it would be, and really does point to this mixed economy notion that you speak about, Mark Ware. A mixed economy is going to drive change in a variety of directions. And here we're looking at that increased complexity and the industry concentration. But there are some other points that are critical to this. For example, the real globalization piece.
Yeah, and globalization is a trend that is not new and has been perhaps accelerating. And we see some of that coming out in the sort of geographic makeup of the industry here, with players like Baltus Kluwer buying an Indian publisher, Medno, Chinese, Spanish language markets, which are often ignored within. I mean, industry reports that look at the size of the market, like outsells, often don't take account of the size of the internal Chinese language or Spanish language markets in these other parts of the world, for obvious reasons. I've already talked about the new entrance phenomenon at sort of the top of this table here, where we see new people coming in from quite different areas. Funders with eLife or VC startups with ResearchGate and so on. And I think we're all very much aware of the way in which the journal's platform is becoming a more complex product, if you like, complex to support. One thing that I think comes clearly across both in Denny's and in the talk and in the previous slide, if you like, is the way in which the complexity of the ways in which value is created and captured, what's called the value network complexity, is increasing as these systems start to interact and deliver services across a whole range of different platforms.
Well, indeed. And, Mark, we're going to wind things up here before we get to the questions from the audience with a sort of a recap of all this. But one area that we've only briefly touched on in this program, but we have spoken about a great deal in previous programs, is the drive for standards that's going to be so critical to achieving, a really viable open access marketplace and perhaps driving as well some of the efficiency improvements that publishers and institutions are looking for.
And that was something that I think publishers see as an absolutely natural role of the industry, and one that working with librarians in particular has been very fruitful in the past. So very recently we've seen the emergence of the FundRef standard for identifying funders in journal metadata, which has potential it's absolutely critical to the Chorus system for green open access model currently in the United States, but it has all sorts of other potential value. And that was one of the examples that was pointed to, I think, by publishers as to how we can create ways in which the essentially it pointed very much to the efficiency model. This was really the agenda in which it came up. But I think, you know, what actually happens is something quite different, like Chorus, can emerge on the back of some of these standards. So it can both create, you know, internal and market efficiencies, and also create the opportunity for wholly new services as well. So I think it's a very fruitful area.